Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
What I'm going to do today is to tell you about that title, what makes a stem cell a stem cell, and our 30 years of trying to figure out an answer to that question, and perhaps set up what the next 30 years of what the new trainees here are going to do to help answer that. So, the good thing for the trainees, the thing is to pick a question when you're running your lab that's big enough that it'll last a whole, career and a whole lifetime, and perhaps another field or another lifetime in a field as well. And so these are the three things I want to talk about in the rest of the presentation. So, my lab has spent a lot of time initially starting to really understand how leukemia changes between diagnosis and relapse, focusing primarily on AML, although we've done work on BL as well, and the evidence that recurrence is actually due to leukemia stem cells. And there's papers here that have actually given, I think, very solid proof to that. But through a serendipitous finding, actually, we were just looking at the germline control for, this is early days of gene sequencing using a targeted panel. We had 12 leukemia samples, and we're trying to figure out what we're going to use as a germline control. And we just thought, well, let's just use T cells from those samples, because they were archival samples, they've been in the biobank. And when we looked into it, we realized the T cell was positive and realized it wasn't contamination. So the only way that could have happened is if there would have been a common ancestor. And a common ancestor between an AML and a T cell is only a stem cell. And so we start to look in stem cells. So remember, patient sample that we have in our biobank, 80% of the cells are leukemic, 20% of the cells are normal. When you drill into that sample, we looked in the stem population, it turned out that the stem cells, half of them were positive for DNMT3A, which was the gene that was driving that particular leukemia, but that's all. And it was making it was perfectly normal. It was making all the blood cells that you would want for that person, and half of the blood of that person was coming from that single stem cell, and so that set up this cascade of recognition that we can begin to ask what are the pre-leukemic samples. To our shock, a few months after we published that work, a whole bunch of papers came out that basically said this idea that blood stem cells can pick up leukemic mutations is exceedingly common in the normal population. And so that, of course, set off the whole field of clonal hemopoiesis. And so then the question was, what cell is it that actually is the cell of origin? And this was the beginning of an answer. And the question is, how long does it take? What's the first hit? And our ways we look at this is that, the first hit here must be genetic, right? It's the DNP3A or TET2 or whatever the other molecule is that you want. And these are all important questions to do. But what I'm going to tell you is that it's not quite as simple as that. And maybe sometimes the first hits aren't genetic. And in cancer, we're so primed to think that cancer is just a disease of genes gone bad. And cancer is much more than that. Genes are just one element, if you like, and so that's really what my talk is gonna be about. Okay, so that's what we're interested in studying, but of course, the blood system changes with aging. And we know that, from work in the mouse and actually work in the human system, the fitness of human stem cells declines with age. The risk of this clonal hemopoiesis picking up these oncogenes increases, and there's a direct link between clonal hemopoiesis and malignancy. And so, the question is, what is the cause of this loss of fitness? And, you have Rob Signer here, and we've heard a beautiful talk yesterday on stress. So I'll just show one slide on this. But we stumbled onto a gene that was important in stem cells. It happened to be, part of the unfolded protein response, of which I knew absolutely nothing. And we had to sort of look into it in more detail, and that led us to a series of control experiments. And what we realized was that if you give strong proteostatic stress to a stem cell compared to any other cell in the body, the downstream cells, they have a different response to the UPR. So, unfolded protein response, right? Cell gets stressed. First thing that happens is it stops translation with, ATF4 and things like that, and other, enzymes. Then they upregulate chaperones to deal with the proteostatic stress. If it goes on too long, then eventually the PERK pathway comes on and will kill the cell if it goes on for too long. Turns out that stem cells have higher levels of PERK activity than other cells in the bloodstream. And so when they get stressed, their threshold for death is much lower because they already have elevated levels for that. And before that, we had actually again stumbled onto a serendipitous finding that if you give low dose radiation to dormant stem cells compared to progenitor cells, they're actually more sensitive to radiation. And that, you know, at the time is a little bit paradoxic, right? You think a dormant cell can survive radiation because it's not cycling, but actually stem cells are more sensitive to low dose damage to radiation. And I think the, you know, the way that we tend to integrate all of this is that, you know, if a stem cell is born when you're age 20 and it's going to live to the age of, you know, 70, that stem cell has made trillions and trillions of progeny. And if there's any possibility of propagating damage, it's propagating that damage to every single one of the daughter cells that comes out of that. And so there are a lot of evolutionary processes to prevent stem cells from passing on damage. And so we think that these responses to stress are one of those mechanisms to prevent that, in addition to things like dormancy and other features that are protecting stem cells from passing on damage. So the point is that stem cells are wired uniquely actually for stressful situations. One of the stresses that all cells are exposed to, of course, is inflammation. And we know that when a stem cell gets activated with inflammation, when it's exposed to inflammation, it gets activated. So, you know, At one level, of course, you know, the field or, you know, the world, if you like, in inflammation often is focused on the effector cells, right? The T cells that come up, or the, you know, the B cells or the monocytes that respond to some kind of inflammatory, you know, response. But it turns out that many cells respond to inflammation, including stem cells. So the beautiful work in the mouse from Manuel Passeguet and Eric Pietras and others have documented this in, you know, beautiful studies. Very few studies have been done in the human system to see, you know, how the human system is organized. But the point is, cells get activated and then they go back into dormancy in an acute response. The question is, what happens if you have chronic inflammation? And again, you know, beautiful work has shown that if stem cells are chronically activated, you end up getting a situation where they look just like an aged blood system. And so it's like accelerated aging if you just expose them to chronic inflammation. And that sets up a cascade where these cells have impaired self-renewal and much higher myeloid output, which are the canonical features of an aged stem cell system. And if that goes on for too long, then it sets up a cascade where you can actually get, you know, malignancy going forward. So, you know, hematological or inflammation is a feature. And then again, the question is, what happens in the blood system? We know in clonal hemopoiesis that many of the molecules, like TET2, for example, is very pro-inflammatory. So the TET2 mutation in the stem cell, those stem cells make myeloid progeny. Those myeloid progeny have much higher levels of secretion of IL-6, amongst other things. And so that sets up, you know, an inflammatory milieu. But as I'll tell you in a second, there are things that are happening before that that are also inflammatory that don't have anything to do with CH. So that's kind of where we're at. So this all, you know, our approach into this actually began more from our approach to try to gain a molecular understanding of the blood system, of the human blood system. And there have been several maps that have been reported, and there's new ones that are coming out now. The problem with the original maps here, for example, they were quite large. They had many, you know, hundreds of thousands of cells. The problem was that, you know, bone marrow is very, and, you know, they have a label, and the labels are different cell types that are inferred based on gene expression, and there's a little label that says stem cell. The trouble is that if you actually went back and looked at that data, there's like a handful of stem cells in the stem cell label of cells, because stem cells in bone marrow are very scant. And what Andy did was he looked at other data that had been generated where it was enriched from CD34 positive, which is at least enriched for stem cells to some extent. And so we put this all together to create a more balanced map, so we have much better representation of the downstream parts, but also the stem cell part. So it's about 250,000 cells. And now we have, you know, a label, and there's our label for stem cells right there. And the question is, how good is that? Is this any better than any other system? Now, the beauty in the blood system is that, of course, over the years, a lot of effort has been spent to try to purify those stem cells all the way down to all the different lineages going forward. And those purified populations have been validated with functional assays, typically single-cell functional assays. So we know exactly what a cell that has that phenotype does in a series of functional assays. And in parallel, there has been now gene expression on those same sorted populations. And so if you have that set of phenotypes, it lands mostly in that particular window there. And, you know, these were cells that were called MPP with that particular phenotype. And, you know, they're kind of going in that direction. They're primed for megakaryocytic erythroid. And that's what those cells do at single cell resolution. So there's functional data that underlies that gene expression. And so this whole system has been, you know, essentially validated based on this historical data. And so the point that I'm trying to make is that, you know, there's a whole bunch of cells here that are all multilineage. They'll all repopulate in this context that is xenograft. It's just these do it short term, these are more intermediate, and these are the ones who will do it long term and are able to do it in a serial way. They have self-renewal capacity. And, you know, we applied one of these markers, and, you know, in our best experiments is 1 in 3, probably not quite that high, but let's say 1 in 3, 1 in 6 cells, you know, is a long-term serially propagating stem cell at single cell resolution. And when you look at where these cells land, so this is 5,000 cells sorted with 49F, they all land there. So one level, and you'll see how I use this, this of course is a very good tool then. We can take any data set and use this as a map. And if any cell lands there, I can say, well, that's a stem cell in that particular data set, and I can now study it and validate it. And so, you know, this is a very poor population. So our next step was, well, what are the molecular determinants that drive this, you know, what makes a stem cell a stem cell? And so we went through, you know, the whole algorithm, did a bunch of, you know, machine learning and, you know, things that I understand when my trainees or my informaticians, you know, tell me about it. And then, of course, afterwards, it kind of all bleeds away. But, you know, it's a whole set of CNMF and other approaches to try to find the pathways that are relevant in this pure population. And what came out of that, I'm not going to show you the data, but there's actually 18 different clusters that came out of this, what we think, you know, quite pure population of cells. And so the question is, why are we getting this diversity? And when we look at the diversity, what is quite interesting is that, so here's the cells in that window. And when you look at the pathways and programs that are there, there's an NMF signature, which is what you would expect a stem cell to be. It's, you know, it has dormancy, it has high features of stem versus progenitor, and there are some of the features in there, and there's a lot of quiescence programs in there. But you can also see that there's other cells there. Each of these dots is essentially one of those cells. But there's another set up here, which is very wired in for inflammatory signatures. And we can see it from a gene-based, but we can also see it from the, you know, from the ATAC-based, from the chromatin-based signature. Another signature here, which is the canonical stem-like. We expect to see that in a stem cell population. What we don't expect to see in a cord blood, you know, cell is to see all these inflammatory signatures wired in. And you know, so the question is, you know, what's going on? Why are these stress programs wired at birth? And that led us to ask, is there functional behind these properties of these cells? And so Stephanie Shi, who's an affiliate scientist in our cancer center, she's affiliated with my group, along with Andy Taz and Askar, we later on collaborated with Paresh Vyas's lab at Oxford, and that's what the story I'm going to tell you about is on. So we created this model where we took human, you know, primitive cells, cord blood, transplanted mice, let engraftment happen. Now we know from prior work that we had done that when stem cells are transplanted, all the dormant cells, because they're cord blood, they're all mobilized, they're all dormant. Even progenitors are dormant. You transplant them, they all get activated, and by 4 to 6 weeks, all the stem cells are cycling. If you wait till 20 weeks, all those stem cells are back to being dormant. And so we asked, well, you know, if we expose these to an inflammatory signal, TNF or LPS, so one shot, and we look 16 hours later, so an acute response, and this is well studied in, you know, many systems, including the mouse, and we got exactly what you would expect. So 16 hours later, this is the level of human engraftment. Each cell is a mouse. And so you can see that the exposure of a single hit of TNF or LPS really reduces the extent of that graft, and it does it whether it's in a cycling fashion or when it's in the dormant fashion. And so this is exactly what you would expect. So it tells us stem cells are responding to an acute inflammation. So our mimic of a chronic setting is this, where we, and I should just tell you here, if we were to now carry out a study 2 weeks later, these are completely normalized. I mean, I'll show you a piece of data in a second, but that's essentially. So this is there acutely, and then it goes back within a week or two back to normalcy. So here, what we did is we engraft and happen, and then we hit them with one dose. We wait for about a month or so, hit them with a second dose, and then we wait for 2.5 months. And just ask, is there any consequence of this going forwards? And so this is now the single challenge here, where we hit them once, and then we wait for 20 weeks, and nothing happens, right? Or nothing happens. They've completely recovered. So that 16-week drop, 20 weeks later, nothing has been impaired, no memory. But if you repeatedly challenge, there's still a huge persistence of impairment of how the stem cells are functioning in those mice. Even the fact that they've only, the last time they saw an insult was 2.5 months earlier. So these stem cells have some memory of the prior insults that they had early on. And so we want to understand what the molecular underpinnings of that was. Created a whole bunch of mice because stem cells are rare and we needed to collect enough of them here. And so we sorted them out at that 20 weeks after the dual challenge, subjected them to multiome because again, you know, when cells are very similar, gene expression isn't very good. Chromatin accessibility, epigenetics is a much better predictor of cell state when cells are very similar. And we'd seen this, you know, we can look at, for example, dormant LTHSCs and activated LTHSCs. It hasn't started that cell cycle, but it's decided that it's going to divide. And you can capture chromatin differences between those, and you can't capture any gene expression differences. So that's why we focused on multiome analysis. So again, this is what those populations of cells look like out of a mouse. And we then computationally focused on those cells. And to our surprise, what we saw were two stem cell populations, operationally termed HSC1, HSC2. So you can say, well, you know, it's just a UMAP, how do you know? Well, we have really, really good signatures, a gene-based signature of LT versus a downstream progenitor, and it only labels the tips, but it labels the tips of both of these areas. And we have an ATAC-based signature that we had reported on some years ago of LTHSC, and again, it only labels up the tips. And the surprise was when we looked at this in more detail and looked at some of the programs that were coming up, it turns out that, you know, that inflammatory signature that I showed you earlier, it's not equally distributed between these. This one down here has, you know, you can see my window. This one down here has a lot more activity of the TNF-beta, and it's associated with quiescence. So there's something disparate about these HSC1 and HSC2. And so then the question was, well, if we have two stem cell populations, which one is responding to an inflammatory insult? Is it both of them or not? Because, I mean, I'm going to draw it out, but when we do multiome on cord blood, we don't see this. So in the PBS control, you see this coming up. So just the act of transplantation is enough of a stress to bring out this population. So just remember that. And so what we're doing then computationally, because we have multiome, we can understand what the transcription factor networks are in two ways. One is we can use a classic, you know, peak base, right? Because we have ATAC data, we can look at what are the peaks that are open in each of these cells and what are the transcription factors that bind those peaks. Or we can also look at the genes that are expressed and infer what the TF was that's driving that. And so what you get is data like this. So here is just an example of NF-kappa-B. Here's the expression of NF-kappa-B, here's the expression of REL. It's only in the HSC2, not the HSC1. And here's the, you know, gene-based regulon, the ATAC-based regulon. And this is, you know, David, immunologist here, will say that is an inflamed cell, or that population is an inflamed. And so this is now the whole cascade of data. And the first thing which is very striking is, if you expose HSC1 to TNF, nothing happens. These cells do not respond. Whereas the HSC2 are the cells that are really responding. So if you just look at all the data, if this is the PBS control, basally the HSC2 is already wired up for that inflammatory signature. But when you hit them with the TNF, you can see it really pops up going forwards. Now, you know, I'm going to give you a whole talk on HSC2, but I get questions all the time. What is it about HSC1 that resists inflammation? I think there's an equally important question that underlies that, of which we're doing nothing on at this moment. But I think it's an interesting one. Okay, so what we're saying then is that there is this cell that retains memory of a prior inflammatory insult. And so operationally, then we renamed HSC2 with HSCIM. So that's what the terminology I'm going to use from now going forwards. And so the question is, this is all great, John, you know, it's a human cell in a mouse, like, big deal. This is the reviews I get from most of my papers for the last 30 years. it's all been done in the mouse. Anyway, so, well, what's the canonical memory system? Well, memory T cells, right? And there's this beautiful work from Rafi Ahmed where they took patients with yellow fever, or they took donors and injected them with the yellow fever vaccine. At the same time, they fed them heavy water because they wanted to see which cells are responding, and then you can use heavy water to find them later on. I was in Brazil. Actually, Kat and I were in Brazil in many, many years ago in Iguaçu. And when we went to, and we were going to the Amazon afterwards, and so we got a yellow fever vaccine. So yellow fever. And if any of you had it, you have it. And like 12 hours later, I'm sitting at home and just shivering like that. Man, that's quite a vaccine. Anyway, so what they what Ahmed's lab did was they captured, you know, the effector cells, and then they waited, you know, over a decade. And with heavy water, you can find, you know, memory T cells. And we went back and reanalyzed their data. And what we did was generate a signature of their memory T cell data sets, created a differential signature and mapped it. And you can see it only maps onto our IM. And we've, of course, done it the other way around, which is we took their signature and mapped it onto our data. And this HSC-IM is coming up only in the long-term memory population and not the others. And so there seems to be some convergence of how memory is encoded in these two different populations of cells. I'll just parenthetically tell you, we haven't done a lot of work, but we don't see it with a B cell response. So trained immunity, the classic trained immunity, we don't see signatures coming up that are reported in the literature. But of course, you know, the question was, well, what about like a real infection? Well, you know, what did we all go through? COVID. And so we managed to see this bit of data and connected with Steve Josefowicz at Cornell, who had this beautiful data set where they had taken patients who were sick enough that they were in the ICU and they recovered. And they took them 2 to 4 months after, but the trick was that he took a large amount of blood, about 100 mLs of blood. And so this allows you to do a 34 selection, and you can actually capture the rare stem cells that are actually found in, you know, people. And that allowed us to actually mine their, go back and remine their data using our map to find actually the stem populations. And we could then ask, what do they look like in patients who recovered from COVID? There are controls of people in the ICU just for car accidents and healthy controls. And you can see very strong enrichment of our signature of inflammatory memory only in patients who recovered from COVID and not just being in ICU or in age. And we can see it with the chromatin signature and the gene expression-based signature. And again, we make a signature of their data and map it back into ours. You can see, let me look at the AUCs are really high. It's really mapping specifically into that HSC-IM side of things. Well, what's the other clinical setting? Aging. Right? So as we age, we are the sum total of our inflammatory experiences. And the older we are, the more inflammation we've uncovered. There isn't as much aging data out there. Here are three studies. We've contributed our own to this. And and you can see that when we look at, we binned all these data sets into being, you know, middle-aged or old. And unfortunately, I'm in that old category. Shocking. And you can see that we only see our IM signature in the aged side of things here, right? So there's a very strong enrichment. The NESs are very good here on this data set. And then we went the other way around and made an aging metasignature from all this data. It's a 37 gene signature. You map it back, it maps really into the HSC-IM. I should say that metasignature is going to be really useful for, I think, many people in the field of aging. Okay, so that's, you know, the another clinical setting, right, aging. And then the other one, of course, is CH. I already introduced it at the beginning, right? The idea is that depending on how deep you sequence, but if you look at, you know, 1 in 3 people over the age of 60 have colon hemopoiesis, so very high, benign in most people. You know, in the 4 out of 100,000 people of that age who are going to go on to get AML, there's a much higher incidence if you have colon hemopoiesis to get AML. But of course, CH has been linked to many inflammatory diseases, cardiovascular disease. We've worked with our cardiologists in our place. We have 3 or 4 papers on, you know, the link between, you know, TET mutations and, you know, heart failure, whether you're in the ICU or at home. And then out of the 500 patients who were in the ICU, 100 of them went on for heart transplant. If you have CH, you do much more poorly with a new heart than if you don't. We looked at, you know, myosin-driven hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And again, TET in particular is highly linked to that. So, you know, it's linked to, you know, arthritis and, you know, many other features. And so the question is, what's the link between, you know, inflammatory memory and CH? So if I'm telling you there's 2 stem cells there, are they both equally able to pick up a CH mutation? What's the link if you have a CH mutation? I mean, there's, many questions, but you need to be able to mine it. And the problem that we have right now is that we have no prospective marker for this in HSCIM. And that's a big limitation of anything that we can say. We can only capture it molecularly. But the beauty is that there are technologies that you can begin to do. And Paresh is one of the people who really pioneered target sequencing. So what you can do is you can do site-seq. So you're doing typical, you know, antibody-based single-cell RNA sequencing. It's plate-based. So actually, they can capture very high numbers of genes per cell because it's a plate-based system. So we know what cell is going in, and we can use markers out of the bone marrow that was taken and say, well, that's a cell that's a stem cell. We can know what the gene expression programs are, and then he can apply gene tagging and ask, well, that stem cell bears a 3A mutation and that one doesn't, or that has a TET mutation and that one doesn't. And so this is done on patients who don't have CH and patients that do. And in patients that do, we can compare the cell that has, it's, we call it wild type or CH bearing. And so one can begin to do various comparisons. So one comparison you would do is just this versus that. And that's what's sort of shown here. And when we looked at their data for sort of a cursory way, it was very clear that inflammatory signatures are much higher if the CH mutation is there. And that's true for 3A and it's true for TET. The other thing is that, you know, our definition of inflammatory memory, at the end, it comes from a xenograft, right? It comes from this artificial system of a human cell and a mouse exposed to inflammatory insults. When Paresh looks at his own stem cell data, he could see that there are actually two main stem cell populations. He called them HSC1, HSC2. A little bit, I mean, it's unfortunately very common to what we have, so it's a little bit confusing. So just let me walk you through it. So what we did is, so he marked these just from his own data set, from these humans, right? This is not an artificial system, this is a human. And when we mapped, we took his signatures and we mapped our HSC1, it only labels that guy. If we take our HSCIM, it only labels that guy. So his HSC2 is just like our HSC1. And then we did it the other way around. Is we made a signature of his HSC1, and it only labels up that. We took his HSC2, this one over here, and it only labels up the HSCIM. So it works in both directions. So we now have a lot of confidence that HSCIM isn't just an artifact of a crazy xenograft system. It actually happens in real people. You can look at differential genes that are expressed between these two. And there's way more differences in the HSC2, HSC2 share many of the differential expressed genes. And so then you can begin to play the comparison. So I kind of already showed you this axis here. You can actually ask that axis there. What about these wild type cells? They happen to be in the milieu. And remember, when somebody is CH, that's the definition is anything over 2%, right? Any more than 2% of your blood, then you're called CH. Only maybe 2 out of 100 stem cells are going to be like this, and the other 98 are going to be like that. And the question is, does that being in that milieu, does that do anything to these cells? And it turns out that it does. So that's this axis here, wild type versus control. So that's this arrow. And you can see strong enrichment of our HSCIM signature. This is the one that I kind of already showed you, the mutant versus the control. And then this is the other one, and I'm going to come back to this because we can learn a lot from this comparison. So what about that? If a stem cell in a person who has CH, what about that stem cell versus that? It's actually still enriched. Not quite as much, but it's still enriched. So the presence of the mutation is enhancing the IM signature. And I should say, it's doing these enrichments are happening almost equally for 3A and TET2. I sort of alluded to TET2 is much more inflammatory in humans than 3A. 3A is a very subtle CH mutation, has a very low competitive advantage. It's very common, but the competitive advantage is very low. 3A or TET2 is much more. But in the data I'm going to show you, there's a lot of similarity between 3A and TET2, suggesting that there's something else going on here. It's actually the cellular milieu, as opposed to the gene, is having an impact. So, I'm showing NESs there, but the question is, how significant is that pathway? How significant is our signature of HSCIM? So we went to the effort of making, we took all the hallmarks, all the known signatures, so, 8,000 signatures and 8,000 pathways, and we basically just ran them against this data comparison. And so if you compare the wild type to the control or the mutant to the control, You can see that it's the number one signature out of 8,000 signatures. So this is a prominent distinguishing feature of that particular comparison. Remember this, I'm going to come back to it. The mutant, so this is this comparison here, the mutant to the wild type. It's still high, number eight, but it's gone down from number one. So there's something about the presence of the mutation here, which is doing something, presumably in this population of cells. I think I just said that. Okay, so I just showed you this data. The IAM signature is enriched in the presence of the mutation. So that's fine, but the IAM signature is not a monolith. There are many other features that underlie it. And to our shock, when we looked at some of the detailed pathways that underlie that comparison. So I already told you, I introduced this, that HSCIM is highly correlated to inflammatory signatures, inflammatory signaling. But if you look, if you actually look at TNF signaling, the presence of the mutation is actually downregulating NF-kappa B. So what this is suggesting is that, you know, you could be having a whole bunch of these wild-type HSCs, but if it acquires a 3A or a TET2 mutation, what it's doing is it's actually down-regulating some component, particularly around TNF signaling. And as I'll show you in a second, so it seems like it's being attenuated by the presence of the mutation. And this is now starting to think about, well, why is CH being selected for? And what I'm going to lay out then in the next, I'm almost finished, but the next couple of slides is that there's something about this attenuation that the CH mutation is doing, which actually underlies the selective advantage that it gives that cell. Because remember, one of the things I told you at the beginning, when a cell becomes HSCIM, it becomes dormant. So this adaptation to chronic inflammation is, stem cells don't like to be overactivated. And here the failsafe isn't death as it was in proteostatic or low-dose DNA radiation. Here it's dormancy. But of course, at a single cell level, you're protecting purity and so forth, and that's great. At an organismal level, if all my stem cells are doing that, that's not a good thing, right? If I'm 70 and I've had many repeated inflammations and I'm losing a lot of my stem cell pool, that provides a very strong selection pressure. And the question is that true? I don't have the slide here, but there's a beautiful paper 2 years ago in Nature from Peter Campbell and Lisa Lorente, where they had done one of these heroic experiments you can only do at the Sanger, where they had done single cell whole genome analysis of clones from individuals at young, middle-aged, and elderly. And when that allows you to use the variants that come up in any whole genome sequencing as a way to track back lineage all the way to the egg, actually. But what that allowed them to do is to calculate the number of stem cells that are active in any one of those people. And what they showed is, if you're young or even into the age of 60, you have 100 to 200,000 active stem cells. They had three individuals at the age of 70. At the age of 70, they were down to 10. So there's a massive compression of diversity in the elderly. And we think that this might be a mechanism that underlies that. But what that does at an organismal level is create massive selection pressure to overcome that. And so, this looks like, here's our inflammatory memory signature. Here's the VAF, that is the clone size going forwards. And you can see there's a linear increase. So the higher the higher the inflammatory memory signature, the higher the clone size, meaning that there must be some kind of a link between the clonal expansion and the presence of the mutation. And when we look at this then in a little bit more detail, you can see that there are some really interesting features here. This is a place where the 3A and the TET, they're a little bit disparate for some of these features, but look at this. The 3A, if you look at this comparison, so all the things that are happening are in the HSC2 or the HSCIM population. Nothing is happening in HSC1. But what's happening is you can see that there's an enrichment of the young signature. So the presence of the mutation is reprogramming, if you like, or it's making that HSCIM old signature. It's actually causing the young signature to come up. You can see there's a change in these cells are much more activated. We're seeing cycle prime. We're getting less of the dormancy signatures going through. They're looking a little bit more like an activated short-term stem cell instead of a dormant long-term stem cell. So we think that this is where the selective advantage is coming from. We think that what happens is that when you get to the age of 70, you have all of your stem cells are HSCIM, not all, I'm being facetious, but you know, many of them are. That causes a disadvantage. They then pick up a CH mutation, and that's why the wild type and the CH look the same. It's because they're coming from the same source, and it relieves the negative consequence of these cells. And so there's a long way to say that what it's doing is the CH mutation is attenuating the adaptation or the deleterious effects of aging and inflammation, and that's what gives a competitive advantage. So what we're then, to conclude this part, what we're basically saying is, well, the first set is a stem cell, but it's actually probably an HSCIM. It's not, because there's now more heterogeneity, we need to think of what it is, and we think it's an HSCIM. And the first hit is not genetic. The first hit is inflammation. And the genetic part is a way of rescuing the negative adaptation here. And that's what, because the adapted response to inflammation is dormancy, this relieves them of that, and then it sets up the cascade for going forward. Okay, I've told you about HSCIM, but what does HSCIM do? And to really say, what I need to do is to basically have an assay. Remember, I can't purify these cells. I can only know them after the fact. And what I want to know is, an HSCIM, what kind of progeny does it make? But I need to do a lineage trace. And, I'm not a mouse system, so I can't just put in a barcode and just track, here's a stem cell, it's HSCIM, and now I look at that barcode and I look going down. However, because we did single cell analysis, we can actually use a trick. And the trick is we can actually use supercell as a way to take, because so much genetic diversity in the cord blood donors that we used, the aficionados know what supercell is, but it's a way of, it's a control that you use in your 10x analysis. But it's essentially just marking, germline variants in the transcriptome that determine identity. And so we can actually use that to create clusters. And then you can basically say, well, here's a stem cell from, somebody like this, and it's an HSC1 stem cell, or it's an HSC2 stem cell. And we can then look at what the progeny are. And what the progeny are like this. And so what that has led to, I'm going to skip over all of this, but essentially to say that when we look at the downstream progeny, we see propagation. I'm skipping over a lot of stuff. What we see is propagation of the signature, the HSCIM signature, to all the downstream progeny up to monocytes. And we only see that in the HSC2 population, not the HSC1 population. So it looks like what's happening is that if I'm an HSC1, I'm actually training, if you like, the downstream progeny to be primed, because I can see these signatures coming up even though they're mature cells, which raises some interesting questions, right? Because one of the things that's always been confusing is if I have an inflammation, the cells that respond, the professional responders, have a very short half-life, right? If I have a cut down here and I have a big pussy wound, the monocytes, the granulized sites, and so forth, they have a lifespan of, 24 hours, maybe a little bit more. So how do you sustain a long-term response? Do you regenerate it all the time? But it seems like if a stem cell has been sensing that, it's actually making progeny that are already primed to start, doing it. So I think it makes more sense in terms of what might be happening. And I'm no immunologist, so that's all hand-wavy. This is all data. This is essentially the data that supports what I just finished telling you. Let me just cut to this part here. So summary. I think I've summarized most of the things here. This is the last stuff. So HSCIM transmits pro-inflammatory properties to downstream progeny. So I'll just leave you with one sort of cool stuff at the very end. So what we were interested in, of course, is asking, we need to have a marker to isolate the IM from the other. And so we, of course, mine our omic data, and we're looking at genes that are differential on the IM versus the HSC1 side. And we came up with a really strongly differential gene called CD83. It's expressed very well here and not here. Those of you immunologists know that it's a marker, which is important in a variety of inflammatory settings. It hasn't been studied, obviously, in the course of the human system. It turns out that if we look in cord blood, we don't see it as a, it doesn't come up, right? It's not, we don't see it. So it's not a marker we can use to prospectively isolate HSCIM. But as I'll show you in just a couple of little slides here, what it is it's an exquisite sensitive, it's exquisitely sensitive at capturing an inflammatory response. So if we just woof these cells with some TNF. I think this is 16 hours, but we can see it at, you know, a few hours later. It really amps up, and it really amps up in the long-term stem cell, not even so much in the downstream progeny. So it looks like it's actually a functional marker of response that these cells are seeing when they get hit with TNF. And this is just another example of that. Over a culture time, it really comes up, you know, quite quickly. TNF really drives it. The other thing I'll just say is that, let me just skip over that. And so the question is, okay, it's a marker, but the question is it a functional marker? And the only way we can do that is by CRISPR editing. And so we CRISPR edited this out of our hematopoietic cells. And what you can see, so remember, if you take a stem cell, you hit it with TNF, you see a reduction in primitive cells. That's what we're showing here. So that's the control, if you like. This is OR, it's just the olfactory receptor. That's the control we always use. And you can see that if you knock 83 out, you really get a diminution of the ability of TNF to actually cause a marked reduction. So that's just, you know, looking at, you know, in vitro work. If you do transplant work, so I'm just going to move through this. If you do a transplant of these marked cells, and you do this, and I'll go right to the end here, and you do our dual challenge and look 20 weeks later. So again, here you can see these are, this is just the MFI of 83 on the cells. And so you can see that the dual challenge is causing these cells to have a higher level of CD83. And if you knock it out, it doesn't happen. And here you can see that you really are not affecting the loss of primitive cells. So again, if the dual challenge, you get a reduction in primitive cells in the control. And if you knock it out, you basically prevent the loss, if you like, of stem cells in response to this. So we're quite excited about 83 as a potential, you know, not only marker of an activated or an inflamed HSC, but it actually might be functional. And that then raises the interesting question about, you know, could it be used clinically? And yeah, that's just sort of some of the data showing that if you knock it down, you really rescue the functionality of these cells. And so I'll just leave with my last slide. We've been working with Jonas Madsen, who's our allotransplant program, looking at patients who have poor graft function. So this is this very classical setting in allotransplant patients. They're engrafted, they're all you know, donor derived. It's just their stem cells aren't functioning very well. And they are they could respond to some of them will respond to TPO agonist. But they don't predict in advance who does what. But these patients have some kind of an inflammatory, you know, setting. And when we just ran some flow panels on that data and you look at the primitive cells, we can actually see 83 up in those patients who are classified at day 60 post-transplant as being high. So I think there's some prospect for this being clinically relevant. So I'll stop with that and acknowledge my colleagues going forward, particularly Paresh. Thanks very much for your attention.
That's amazing. So I was wondering, my favorite question is to look at the effects of steroid hormones or stress hormone. Did you separate males versus females, or maybe some people who had autoimmune disease or had been on any kind of you know, corticosteroid therapy?
So this is pretty new data, and so the answer is no, we haven't done any of that. Stay tuned. If you know, maybe if I come back to the other stem cell symposium, we're when we look at our signatures, particularly the LTHSC signatures, we've stumbled onto some sex dimorphic signatures that underlie that, and we're really tracking hard down that axis. It's a bit too early to talk about because I'm not 100% confident of all the data, so I don't want to lead you astray, but I think there's going to be some very interesting sex dimorphic components of HSC in particular. I'm not quite sure what HSC I am or not, but it is. So.
Thank you so much. Great talk. So you mentioned that the CD83 was expressed in dendritic cells. Is it also expressed in macrophages, microglial cells? So then I was wondering about its potential impact in neuroinflammatory diseases.
Yeah, you know, I mean, so you know, the answer is I don't know. But I think that there are enough links certainly between clonal hematopoiesis and, you know, many of the diseases of aging that have an inflammatory component. You know, there's a little bit of, I would say, controversial data about CH and neurodegeneration. I mean, SID has some data where it seems like it's protective, and other people would have data that perhaps it's not. And so I think that it's still an open question. But I think in general, you know, there is going to be a strong link. I think what our data puts forward is, even if you don't have CH, this inflammatory memory, you know, component of the blood system could have an underlying feature. You know, one of the things that, you know, somebody asked me, I was at the Hutch a week or two ago and giving this talk, and, you know, people were sort of commenting on the COVID stuff. I mean, if you think that all the people who had really severe COVID, are we facing, you know, in 10 years, people who are going to really, you know, their blood system is really starting to, you know, decline, or their stem cell compression is going to be much, much worse because of that. I mean, these are all sort of open questions that needs to be studied.